Think about psalms and about poems and poetry and how they're poetry. And then I suppose a set of reflections on this particular psalm as our starting point. And I think it's kind of going to be somewhat the nature of the whole of this series. Because, you know, it's already been mentioned, psalms, essentially this is the hymn book of the Jewish people that we're looking at. And their prayers, and they would be the foundation of their collective worship, and they'd also be something that was a regular resource for them in their life of following God. But they're also poems. You know, in some ways, perhaps it's most helpful to think of them as the lyrics to songs. We don't have the actual tunes anymore, and so we're mostly just reading them, but that's what they were for the most part. And being, I guess it's most of our experience that it's often much easier to remember the lyrics of a song than it is just to remember some arbitrary piece of text. It's got rhythm and it's got a tune, and it's something that we can sing, we can say together. And the other really critical thing about poems and about songs is that they're much more about expressing emotion, about what comes from the heart. They're not news reports, they're expressions of who we are and what's going on in us and with us. And they're also prayers. So they're poems directed to God, the prayers of God's people, which now happily includes us. So in this series, we're going to look at 12 particular psalms, and following the suggestions of Eugene Peterson. And as you can see, inattention, intimidation, the first two are kind of introduction ones. They were trouble, creation, sin, salvation, fear, hate, tears, doubt, death, and praise. In general, we're seeing in them examples of the way that God's people have expressed these different kinds of concerns and emotions to God in their relationship with God, and using that as a jumping off point or an inspiration, hopefully, for us. Gareth asked, perhaps rhetorically, what is prayer? For me, maybe the best answer is prayer is all of life that's lived in the awareness of God. Whatever we do with that awareness of God, that is prayer. And one of the most fundamental qualities of good prayer, if I can call that, is honesty. Actually being real with God. Not about performing. God obviously knows who we are, but we have to recognize and respond to that. So prayer is all the ways that we respond to God in our lives. And so as we look at these various aspects of the experience of each of us, then we'll have a chance, hopefully, to practice relating to God in those different ways. And then within the broader parts of the service, it'll be over to the service leaders to hopefully help us, as we're doing today, to try praying in some different ways. And that's the general plan. So the Book of Psalms, the Bible is a library. The Book of Psalms itself is a library. And the Psalms have been written at different points over quite a long period of time, maybe over up to 1,000 years. So some of them probably were written by David, some of them written much later. And then they've been assembled and edited into a collection, which is, in its current kind of form, is divided into 5 sections. And the first two are probably the oldest ones. They're probably the ones that do date more back to kind of David and the earlier period. And the later ones, a lot of those seem more like they've been written a bit later on in the story of the Jewish people. 5 may be a little bit arbitrary. The Jews really like the Pentateuch, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, so maybe that's why there's 5. But anyway, there is some overall structure. Talk a little bit about poetry. Like I said, very much like lyrics. Think about how they work. I was going to spend sort of maybe 5 minutes thinking together about how poetry works. And I'm obviously not an English teacher, so I'm blagging my way mostly. But clearly there's something there about meaning. There's a lot of emotion. You know, poetry isn't about expressing, as I said, you know, facts and observations. It's about expressing something of the heart, something of who we are. And so it makes a lot of use of word pictures, of similes and metaphors and other kinds of analogies to paint pictures in our minds through words of situations and emotions and people's responses. They also have structure. You know, it's not just a linear flow of words without breaks. Often there are patterns and restrictions on length. Often there's a lot of use of rhythm to, you know, and you think if that had music, of course, then it would need that. Also repetition. You think in songs, there are choruses where we repeat things. And poetry also makes a lot of the actual sound of what you're doing. You know, whether that's the way that you place the emphasis as you speak, or in English poetry, in rhymes and alliteration. And, well, here's some examples, just to, so you know what I mean. There was a young man from Peru who dreamt he was eating a shoe. He woke in the night to find with a fright his dream had been perfectly true. So the high watermark of English poetry. But you can see it's got some, you know, common features of poetry in English forms. We've got rhymes, Peru, shoe, true, night, fright. We've got a standard structure with emphases. There was a young man from Peru and dreamt he was eating a shoe, and so on. So it's got quite a strict form. It's a limerick, you know, it's a particular style. And those features help it to... you know, even beyond the meaning, that limerick form helps to make it memorable, and it builds anticipation and helps you to relate to it. And so I came across this example, which also amused me, see if it amuses you. There was a young man from Peru whose limerick stopped at line two. So. Slightly more serious example. I really like kingfishers, you may well as well. And for me, liking them is also bound up with liking this poem, which you may also know by Gerard Manley Hopkins, who's a Christian who wrestled through his life with depression, but also wrote some great poems. And this is one also that Eugene Peterson also draws on, but which has some of the same features, but it's obviously a little bit more challenging to deal with, as poetry often is, but I'll read it just once anyway. As kingfishers catch fire, dragonflies draw flame. As tumbled over rim, in roundy wells, stones ring, like each tucked string tells, each hung bell's bow finds tongue to fling out broad its name. Each mortal thing does one thing and the same, deals out that being indoors each one dwells. Cells goes itself, myself it speaks and spells, crying, what I do is me, for that I came. I say more, the just man justices, keeps grace that keeps all his goings graces, acts in God's eye what in God's eye he is, Christ. For Christ plays in 10,000 places, lovely in limbs and lovely in eyes not his, to the Father through the features of men's faces. So you can spend a long time, you know, trying to work out, for example, what on earth is going on up here in the first verse. But it's a poem that says something about how all of creation just does what it does before God. You know, the kingfishers do kingfisher, dragonflies do dragonfly. And it's a way that they express their divine, their God-given nature. And there's something similar, but a bit more complicated for us, because we also suffer from those sort of existential crises about what's my purpose and what's going on, and I have all this choice about what I do. But we can increasingly allow Christ to express Christ's self through us as God's people. So there's an example in English, still got many of the same features as well. We've still got rhymes, we've still got structure, we've still got rhythm. Now, Translating a poem like that into another language is an absolute nightmare. Imagine you've not only got to translate the meaning, but you've got to try and preserve something of the structure. Can you find translations of those words in the other language that rhyme? You know, will they have different syllables? There's all sorts of problems about translating poetry. But there's some very good news, which is that in Hebrew poetry forms, although, you know, fundamentally it's still about expressing emotion, and there's lots of stuff in there about analogies, similes, and metaphors, but the main other devices they use to give structure and memorability are very much around repetition and saying the same thing in different ways, or saying contrasting things, or elaborating on ideas. So it's much less about the actual sound of it as spoken, and it's much more about the way that the ideas in different lines relate to each other, which is the way that Hebrew poetry forms tend to work. Not exclusively, for example, Psalm 119 is an acrostic. Each verse starts with a different letter of the Hebrew alphabet. That's not obvious to us reading it, except that they put little subheadings in. Now, there's some places you get that, and some alliteration and some rhythm that we lose in translation. But fortunately, most of the guts of the poetry of Hebrew writing we do still have, even translated into English. So, as has already been mentioned to some extent, these first two psalms are a little bit of an exception. You know, I said it was this collection of songs and that have been curated over the centuries, and these are essentially the preface. You know, if you buy a book, you get a preface, a bit at the beginning, where the author has got one of his mates to write a couple of pages about what a privilege it is to know the author and how everyone should read this book because it's fantastic. So it's kind of that bit. The editor of the Psalms at some point has put in these two Psalms as an apologetic, if you know, and a reason. Here's why you should engage with this book. This is why it's great. So I'll step through this first Psalm, first kind of illustrating some of the way that it does poetry, and then, as I said, we'll then sort of reflect a bit more on the meaning and what might be going on. So, blessed is the one who doesn't walk in step with the wicked. We start off with a bit of a contrast, but then let's elaborate that idea. Walk in step with the wicked, stand in the way that sinners take, sit in the company of mockers. Different perspectives on the same idea that get elaborated line by line. Switch perspective, their delight is in the law of the Lord. Well, let's elaborate that, let's build on that. Who meditates on his law day and night. So again, starting to build up richer pictures and images by looking at them in different ways. That person is like, simile, okay, let's use some more word pictures, a tree planted by streams of water. Okay, let's develop that idea a bit. It yields its fruit in season. Its leaf doesn't wither. Whatever they do prospers. Change perspective. What about those wicked people? They're like chaff. So not like trees. The wind blows them away. And where does that lead us? The wicked will not stand in the judgment, or equivalently, nor sinners in the assembly of the righteous. So again, just different ways of reinforcing the same ideas. Let's flip back. The Lord watches over the way of the righteous. Again, a bit of a picture, our life as a journey. But the way of the wicked leads to destruction. So, you know, hopefully they get a little bit of a glimpse of some of the things that are going on in there. You know, we've got all those sort of similes and metaphors. You know, where the blessed are like a tree, and what's that like? Well, let's sort of unpack that. It's fruitful, it prospers, and so on. The wicked, on the other hand, contrasting views, like chaff, useless, blown away. Now, obviously, some of what a given psalm says will make a lot of sense to us. Some of it we may have to do a bit of digging to understand maybe a little bit more of what it meant for its first hearers. So what it means for a tree to be by water depends on, you know, what sort of trees you're used to and what sort of water you're used to. If you live in a relatively arid place in the Middle East, then the idea of a tree being by water is probably a lot more significant than it is for us. And similarly, if you don't routinely thresh grain, you probably don't have very much experience of chaff being blown away in the wind. You know, so you get whereas, you know, everyone at the time would know, you harvest the wheat, you harvest the grain, you give it a jolly good beating on the threshing floor, you throw it up in the air, and literally the useless bits blow away and the heavy heads drop back down. So this psalm is really creating these two pictures and counterposing them. You know, and fairly obviously it's saying, you want to be like this, you don't want to be like that. So what does it say about those righteous people we want to be like? Well, they're not like the wicked, doing all these other things, but they do delight in the law of the Lord and meditate on his law day and night. Now, we'll get back to the righteous and all this meditation stuff in a minute, but first, and we touched on this last week, because you know, this idea of the wicked also appears in our verse for the year, and Rachel talked a bit about that. When, you know, we say wicked, then, you know, you may associate with things like evil, and, you know, it's certainly a bad thing, isn't it? Violent, harmful, ill-intentioned, malicious, clearly wrong, perhaps without remorse, and certainly much worse than I am. Very clearly, none of us here are wicked. That goes, we would think, more or less without saying. But I guess it's worth remembering that this, you know, it's a poem. It's there for dramatic effect. This is kind of a straw man. You know, this is the caricature of the thing that you do not want to be. And there's a danger, you know, in kind of just seeing it in terms of that caricature, that we do just dismiss it and say, you know, there's nothing for us to learn from that. We're not like that. You know, let's just do the positive things. But you may recall, you know, last year we were talking, for example, in Romans, early on in Romans, talked about the nature of sin. And it can be tempting for us, depending on our background, to think about sin mainly in terms of law and law-breaking and those kinds of things. But really, at the end of the day, it's a matter of relationship, of how we relate to God. And so we talked a little bit about, you know, how we have sort of rules and laws, which in some sense, you know, are kind of down at the bottom. You know, no barbecues here because you'll start a fire. You know, think about the Ten Commandments. Here's a set of things, or all the regulations in the Old Testament. You know, so is our problem following all the rules? Well, no, at the end of the day, it's not. Our problem is that we've lost track of God and who God is and how our lives should orient to God. And all of this other stuff is just kind of symptoms, if you like. And somewhere in the middle, behind, you know, for example, particular rules in the Bible, I think there are generally values and principles, you know, where, you know, we sometimes say, although we don't always act it out, that what God has said is for our benefit. And I think we can kind of try and think, well, how is this for our benefit? And to try and understand it better. So the wicked person is the person who is not oriented to God, for whom God is not their reference point. And for us, you know, so Eugene Peterson, in titling this study, has said, you know, praying our inattention. That's his suggestion, is perhaps the biggest challenge of ungodliness that we have today is we just don't attend to God. And if we don't attend to God, then, you know, it may not be evil in the sense that we usually try and think about it and push it elsewhere, but we can live very godless lives. And perhaps for many people in our society now, as much as anything, you know, we might echo the words of Rincon, that are we distracting ourselves to death? One of the biggest challenges, it seems, we live with today is distraction. You know, there are so many other things intruding on our attention moment by moment and day to day that mean that we'll never get round to thinking about anything serious or important or to do with God. Maybe we're just busy. Maybe it's not so much distracted, but, you know, we've got lots of stuff we're trying to do. Maybe we're indifferent. God means nothing to us. Maybe we've so internalized the idea of being the consumer, of deciding what we want, that that's the way we approach the whole of life. Or maybe we feel so confident in our own goodness that we feel no need of God. Or, you know, we just want to do it ourselves. We feel like we are enough. All kinds of ways which I think that, you know, caricature of the wicked, of the one who is kind of walking away from God, for our culture tends to look much more like this. Very mundane, very ordinary, but still practically godless. So the question is, how do we live in right relationship with God? And the psalmist's advice is that we should meditate on his law day and night. And we could spend a long time trying to unpack that, but, you know, I'll just mention a few things. When the psalmist says the law, I guess the law is a deliberately expansive term. You know, sometimes it means the Ten Commandments, sometimes it means the first five books of the Bible, sometimes it means all of Scripture. Like I mentioned, if this is like the preface for the Psalms, then presumably it means at least in part, well, you know, read the other Psalms, work on those. But perhaps more generally, it's worth thinking about, you know, the law of the Lord is really everything that God has revealed and expressed about God's own nature. God's self-revelation, which obviously includes Jesus, but in all the other ways that we come to learn something about God, about the nature of God. You know, the law of God, the rule of God, the nature of God, God's direction for reality, who God is. I think those are the things which are kind of behind that word. How do we meditate on it? Well, meditation has lots of different forms. We may read, we may reflect, we may mull things over, we might debate them, we might sing them, we might listen to them. All kinds of ways, which I guess we'll be trying some of during this series, to, in the words of Psalm 34, taste and see that the Lord is good. So there's something, meditation is both an active and, I suppose, sort of an accepting thing, isn't it? We always depend on God to meet us. We can make ourselves available to him. But we do need to do something, usually to create the space to bring the initiative from our side that can meet God where he was already at work, to see that he is good. How do you do it day and night? Well, it's obviously something of a challenge. The main answer to that is usually practice. Isn't that the answer to most things? You have to practice. You've probably come across Brother Lawrence and Practice of the Presence of God. He's writing here his personal account of how he got to the point where he could do the washing up with God, you know, in a really sort of profound kind of way. Or Frank Lorbach has this game of minutes. When he was, you know, living overseas, he set himself this challenge: could he think of God every moment of the day? And that was Brian Draper I'll mention at the end. All ways that, you know, the other side of that from the psalm, by doing that, by meditating on his law, we can build, you know, we express our delight in the law of the Lord, not just what we're reading, but in the nature of God. It reminded me of this model that Dallas Willard has in Renovation of the Heart. And he suggests that for change, for lasting change in Christian character, we need three things. We need a vision, where we think we're trying to go. And, you know, that's perhaps something like God exists, God cares, and we can live lives continually anchored in God's reality and love. And then we need to make an intention. You know, you can have all sorts of visions, but if you don't decide to pursue them, then they're nothing. You know, they're just dreams. Do we commit ourselves to the attempt to move towards that vision? And if we do, then we need practical means, like continually paying attention to God, meditating on God's word, practicing dependence on God, so on. Lots of different things, all the spiritual disciplines, for example. Lots of ways that we can, if we choose, start to work towards a vision that God has given us of what's possible. And in a way, this psalm is very much like that. It presents these two visions, the vision of the wicked, who is blown away in the breeze, has no value, and the righteous, the blessed person, like that tree planted beside water, which is fruitful throughout. And in terms of means, one which is kind of going with the flow, you know, so we walk in step with the wicked, you know, we just kind of go along with what's going on around us, and we'll stand with the sinners, we'll just stand around and not do much, and we'll sit with the mockers and just take life easy and throw stones at other people. Or we can meditate on the law of the Lord. We can choose to delight in it. We can keep bringing our attention back to God in all sorts of different ways. The way Brian Draper put it in his book, What Matters Most, is, are you awake? We can keep asking ourselves, are we awake in the sense of, have you noticed God's here now, really? It's so easy to move through our whole of life, you know, completely unaware of God's presence of reality, and, you know, there's no prayer in that. But if we can keep waking up moment by moment to the presence and reality of God with us, then progressively we can transform what we do into prayer.